listening to One to One with Paul Costello, a podcast from the Stanford School of Medicine.
Laura Hillebrand is an author of extraordinary success. Her two books, Seabiscuit and Unbroken, are literary phenomenons. Together, there are more than 13 million copies in print, and both have been made into blockbuster motion pictures. Hillebrand wrote the books while besieged with the disease chronic fatigue syndrome. Stricken in 1987, she has endured vertigo and exhaustion so severe that for 2 years she was incapacitated and house-ridden. Recently, Hillebrand has made a lot of changes in her medical treatments and in her life. In this podcast, part of the special issue of Stanford Medicine Magazine on well-being, she discusses her illness, her newfound strengths, and how she is leaving frailty behind. Hi, Laura. Paul Costello.
Hey, Paul. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
So obviously, you choose your words very carefully. So I wondered, you know, I was thinking last night, how would you describe your illness? And what do you call it? Do you call it chronic fatigue? Do you call it something else? How do you describe it?
Oh, the illness is such a pickle, the name. I have called it until maybe 5 years ago CFS, and was always, as is every patient, very unhappy with that name, but it was the name that people understood. Mm-hmm. It's a totally inadequate name. It's a name that causes a lot of misunderstanding and a lot of trivialization of the disease. Now I call it ME-CFS, which I think is probably the most common phrasing now among patients, the ME being myalgic encephalomyelitis, mm-hmm. which is the name that's used in Canada and a lot of other countries. CFS was not used in those countries, and I think patients suffered a little bit less because of that. Mm-hmm. So that's what I call it.
And the suffering, do you think the suffering comes from that when you say chronic fatigue syndrome, CFS, it sort of makes the individual who has the illness be sort of, you know, the target? I mean, as many people have been the target, and you talked about early on when you were first diagnosed that, you know, you got pretty savaged, even within your own family, for the illness.
Yes, I really did. I mean, in terms of what I had to deal with inside my family, that didn't have anything to do with the name.
Right,
but
right.
But outside my family, just in the world, it is a name that is so grossly inadequate in terms of describing the disease. And if you're going to have a name that is a descriptor, as opposed to a name, you know, that's named after a person or after some mechanism of the disease, if it's supposed to be describing the symptoms, chronic fatigue syndrome, it just makes it sound like you're tired all the time, mm-hmm. you know, in a mild way. And so the most frequent trivializing reaction I have gotten from people is, oh, I have that too. No, I'm
right.
tired all the time at the end of the day. And they don't get that I'm talking about being unable to roll over in bed and
yeah.
being unable to speak. And so what I have always said is the word fatigue is to this disease as a match is to a nuclear bomb. I mean, it simply does not come close to describing what you experience. So it was a grievous error of whoever came up with this name. It was disastrous for all of us. I think it has a lot to do with our not getting much funding at all for research,
mm-hmm.
And it has a lot to do with the suffering patients go through in terms of not being taken seriously and accepted. And you have to be taken seriously and accepted in order to get medical care to begin with. So it's really quite critical that the name have a proper, mm-hmm. proper connotation.
Do you think that's changing? Do you feel some sort of sense that the credibility is now changing, that it's now not seen as, you know, I imagine when you hear someone say, oh, I have that, I'm tired all the time, that you just want to scream, you know,
yeah.
do you feel that there's a change coming about?
It's a little hard for me to judge that because I am in the public spotlight, and people are a lot more respectful mm-hmm. to me because of that, because of the books I write. Mm-hmm. And so I think that I am getting the benefit of what I've done in my career that a more anonymous patient might not be getting. For me, in terms of my two books, my first book came out in 2001 and my second book in 2010, there was a very big difference in the way the media dealt with me. When I was promoting Seabiscuit, I had experiences like being mocked on the air in Chicago by radio talk show hosts, as a joke, mm-hmm. because of my little fake disease, you know. And the second time around, people were just much more respectful and understanding. They had learned things in between, in that span of time. Mm-hmm. So I think overall there has been progress, but I can't speak to whether a more anonymous patient is getting a more compassionate reception in the world.
Mm-hmm. Does the term being well ever register for you? What does that mean to you, the term being well?
That's an interesting question. I guess I don't really think about that as an aspiration exactly. I think in more specific terms about if I could do this thing, if I could ride a bike for 50 miles, you know, or if I could climb to the top of the Empire State Building, you know, I mm-hmm. think about sort of specific goals, but I don't know that I think about being well exactly, but I think about is a life in which I'm not having to monitor my body and a life in which I'm not constrained in terms of what I want to do and not having to pay a huge price for what I do. I'm doing much better now than I've done in years, and I've started riding horses, and that's a great joy to me because it was something I did when I was a healthy person, when I was younger, a whole lot. Mm-hmm. And I do it now, but it takes a toll. It's dangerous. You know, I have to mm-hmm. push that red line in terms of my strength, and afterwards I really pay for it. I don't feel good for a couple of days. The rest of the day after I ride, I just sit in bed because I'm so tired. So what I think about is I would love to be able to do that and then go about my day, you know, go mm-hmm. grocery shopping and mm-hmm. not have to think about how I've done that.
Is a horse therapeutic for you? Is the animal therapeutic for you? Is it something that you really find you relate to as a being?
I do for two reasons. For one reason, it connects me to my healthy self in my youth because riding was very, very important to me. I did a great deal of it, and it was something that gave me joy. It was something I escaped into. It's a marvelous feeling to wedge yourself mm-hmm. to an animal of such strength. And now that I've had the experience of being completely incapacitated, to get aboard a 1,300-pound animal with immense power and to be able to partake of that strength and use my mind to guide this animal to give me that strength, it's magical. It's absolutely wonderful. It feels incredible to me. And so it's a better experience than it was when I was younger. Riding is very therapeutic. It's also therapeutic just in terms of it's a physical accomplishment. It's a sport.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and,
mm-hmm.
you know, for decades, I didn't do sports. You know, I maybe could walk around the block, but no, I couldn't do things like that. But now I put on my helmet and my boots, and I just feel like I'm more of a normal person, and I love that.
How did that come about? What was the sort of the moment or the time in which the shift from that got you back on a horse?
I have been undergoing a lot of changes in the last couple of years, a lot of pushing of boundaries. I have done a lot of different things with my treatment and with the way I approach my body. And I think everything has come together to give me, you know, each thing giving me a little bit of push and a little bit of push until I started to test the boundaries and find out, oh, I can do this. And mm-hmm. the more I did, the better I did. I would have mistakes where I would go across that red line and go backwards, and that was very hard, but I have been able to make progress. I'm very fortunate that way. And just one day, I thought, I could get on a horse. I just want to sit on a horse. Actually, the way that particular thing came about was interesting. I bought a draft horse who was on her way to being slaughtered, and just to save her life.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend ended up taking her in. And she turned out to be a lovely horse to have around, and her kids ride it. And the horse was just a sweetheart. And she kept saying, you should come out. You could just sit on her back. And I hadn't even thought of doing something like that. But then I started thinking, I could sit on her back. And I actually never ended up doing that because she was a little bit of a distant drive. But there was a barn near my house in Washington, D.C., where I was living at the time. And I thought, I'll just go out and I'll just get on a horse. And then when I got on it, the person I was with said, well, why don't we try a little riding? And so I did. I rode for half an hour. I was exhausted afterwards and so completely elated.
Mm-hmm.
That's how that got started. And that was each one of those things that I did would make me feel like maybe I can try the next thing. And once I got out here to Oregon, I got on a bike, which was another thing I was really into when I was healthy. And now I'm starting to ride a bike. Not very far. Not very well, but I'm doing it, so it's great.
That's very cool. You talking about new beginnings, and I know that you left Washington, where you lived for many years. You moved to Oregon. It sounds like a big move, a new beginning. How did you think in terms of, taking these leaps and leaving Washington? And, how did you think of those things in terms of, the energy, the psychic energy, sort of the motivation, all those sort of things that, for somebody who doesn't have an illness like CFS and ME, how did you prepare yourself for that?
It took years to get ready to do this. To put you in the perspective of where I was, I had not left Washington, D.C. since 1990. Because of vertigo, which has been a problem for me for most of the time I've had CFS. And it is not a come-and-go kind of vertigo. It has been absolutely constant, where it feels like the floor is pitching up and down. It looks like the room is moving around me. My desk is moving. Everything looks and feels like it's moving. It's hell. It's awful. And it gets worse and better, but it has never gone away. And it has made car travel a nightmare. Or getting in an elevator or an escalator or anything moving is awful and dizzying and miserable. And it can lead to lasting vertigo. So I had taken one trip 2 hours outside of D.C., but had never left the area since 1990 because of the vertigo. And what I started to do, it was the biggest limiting factor for me. Because even when you're exhausted, you can often at least sit in a car and ride around. Another patient might be able to just to get out of the house, but I couldn't do that. And what I began to do is just try to inure myself to it by getting in and riding for 5 minutes. And it would be awful, and I'd feel terrible. I would feel so dizzy for an hour afterwards. But I just wanted to see, if I keep doing this, can I teach my brain how to tolerate it?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd go a little longer and a little longer, and over 2 years, I went from being just miserably dizzy after 5 minutes to being able to go 2 hours. And once I hit 2 hours, I started thinking maybe I could come across the country. My boyfriend is living in Oregon. I wanted to be with him. I wanted to start a new life. D.C. was not the right place to be for someone with CFS. We're very intolerant of heat. It's a very, very hot city, very humid. I wanted a simpler world around me because complicated things are difficult with the cognitive problems with CFS, and where I'm living is more rural. And so I wanted to do this, and I was in love and wanted to be with the man I was in love with.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got an RV, and we took a month-long trip crossing the country, and it was a miracle for me. It was the most wondrous thing, and I can't say that I've ever imagined because I never had imagined doing such a thing.
What were some of the most exciting things that you found or discovered on the trip?
Every single thing was beautiful. Every single thing, every drop of rain, every stretch of highway, every blade of grass was beautiful because I was not in a bed. I was not in a house. And so people kept saying, well, you're going to have to be bored in the Midwest because it's not pretty. I thought it was gorgeous. I was gasping at the grasslands of Kansas. And I thought Illinois was resplendent. Every bit of it was beautiful. And then we went to the Badlands, and, you know, I'd never seen a canyon before, and I just shrieked when I saw it. It was a surprise. My boyfriend didn't tell me we were going, and he said, don't look at the map. I don't want you to know where we are.
Mm-hmm.
And we just pulled up, and the land drops away, and there's canyons everywhere, and I can't describe how overwhelmed I was by the beauty. And we went to the Black Hills, and we went to Spearfish Canyon, and we went out to the West Coast. I put my hand in the Pacific Ocean. We started at the ocean in the east. We started at Delaware. So I got in the water there, and I got in the water in the Pacific. Mostly for me, what I experienced was an overwhelming sense of gratitude. Because I had been set free. I was not well. I am not well. I am, you know, always dealing with symptoms, but I was free enough to have that experience, to see America. I had never seen a mountain before in my life.
Mm.
And now I live between two of them. And it was just overwhelming. And every day I'm so grateful for every single thing, even the things that are very mundane, because I can do them. And it's a weirdly beautiful gift the disease has given me, is to appreciate everything in this world, even the things that you simply take for granted if you're well.
So love has really changed your life in many different ways.
It's the biggest thing that got me to take this leap. And it was very, very risky for me to do this. I could have died on this trip.
Mm-hmm.
I have, when I pushed too far, at one point when I tried to take a trip in 1991, I went into shock and very, very nearly died. I could have landed in bed for another 10 years. It was so risky, but I just believed that I could do it. And I believed in the person I was with, and I thought, I have to try. I cannot live my whole life in a room. I can't do it. I won't do it. I'm willing to risk everything to escape.
Why do you think you're planted here? You just painted this gorgeous portrait of America, of someone who is seeing things fresh, someone who's seeing things from such a untainted, unbiased, uncynical point of view. And I'm wondering, do you spend much time thinking about why are you here? What's the reason that you're here? Is it to write and to really move people? Is it to use words in a way that connects people to human interaction?
Well, I don't know. I think that I can't say whether any of us is here for a purpose,
mm-hmm.
but I can say what I want my life to do. I want my life to be meaningful. I want my life to touch the lives of others in a positive way, if I can possibly do that. That matters to me more than anything. I want to love. I want to love as many people as I can. I want to give as much of myself and whatever gifts I have to other people to make the world better if I can. I write with the goal of serving my subjects in terms of telling their stories and trying to illuminate the world a little bit with what those stories have to offer about living and about history. So those are the things that motivate me every day. I feel I'm going to keep coming back to this because
mm-hmm.
gratitude
mm-hmm.
is what informs my entire life. I feel tremendously grateful and that I've been given beautiful gifts just in being alive
mm-hmm.
and in being an American, being safe, being in an orderly society, being surrounded by so much beauty. And I want to always be conscious of that, of how much I'm given and give back because I'm given so much. I think we are all slumbering in seas of gifts, and we need to be alive to them. The whole world looks different if you feel like the warmth of the carpet under your feet is a gift, you know, or the sun on your skin, or the blades of grass in Kansas. The whole world looks different, and you're more joyful, and you can get through your sorrows more easily. And it's something I would like to show to other people. I want to take what's happened to me in terms of this disease, which has been a pageant of suffering in many ways, and deprivation and incapacitation. If I can take it and turn it into something positive for someone else, then it will have been worth it. And that's tremendously motivating to me.
What do you understand about the mystery of the disease? What do you, the unknown is so unknown, and it's such a mystery. And what do you understand about it?
Do you mean, you know, medically what's happening to me?
Just the way that it envelops you, the way that it overtakes you, the way it sort of... I guess I'm looking for metaphorical. If it were a person, how would you describe it? If you were writing about it, how would you tell the tale of CFS, of ME? You know, what are the qualities of it that are so, you know, overbearing and so enveloping and so powerful? And yet they also, you know, I was interested that the one writer critic said of you that your disease in a way gave you more understanding and perception and the ability to see things so differently than any other writer he's ever read.
Well, I'll break that into two parts. The physical experience of it is akin to being bound in plastic so that you can't move your arms and legs. You can't speak and be heard. You are suffocating. You can't see. It closes off the world to you in a most profound way, so that all that is left of you is the thoughts in your mind, because you just aren't capable of doing anything, of acting into the world or interacting with the world at all. There was a period of time when I didn't leave the house for 2 years. I was too weak to do it. So that is the physical experience of it. You become a purely intellectual thing because you are no longer a physical creature at all. And in terms of what that has given me, I feel like, independent of what the cause of suffering is, that there is this place that suffering takes you that is common to people suffering from all different kinds of things, serious diseases or terrible grief or all of the things that fail us in our lives. I've always felt like there's a place we all go together when we suffer this way. And to have had that experience can be a very valuable thing in terms of what you carry out of it, which is understanding and compassion for all those other people who've been to that place. And for me, in writing Unbroken, which is about veterans at war and prisoners of war and people in horrific states of suffering, is I felt like I was able to climb into their bodies and minds maybe better than I would have been if I'd just been a regular healthy person.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I knew what Louis Zamperini was telling me it was like when he was being held prisoner on Kwajalein Island and having medical experiments done on him by the Japanese. Not that I am comparing my disease to the experience of a prisoner of war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a different and horrible thing that's inflicted upon you by others. But the quality of the suffering, when he and I would discuss it, we understood each other. He knew I knew what he felt. And he told me that enabled him to delve more deeply into it with me than he had with other people he'd spoken to about it. and that he could trust me, and it, that enabled him to open up more. He felt like if he told me this story, I would write it down right. And in the end, he told me I did, that what I wrote was so close to what he felt that he kept having to put the book down and look out the window and tell himself, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here, I'm not there anymore. So that was the strange gift the disease gave, mm-hmm. the ability to reach into the experience of those who are suffering and maybe write about it differently. And I repeatedly had that experience with veterans and prisoners of war where they would learn of my story, or I would speak to them about what I'd been through, and they would just open up and talk to me and trust me. And trust was a big deal with these books, because these are sacred memories for these people. These are the worst things they've ever been through. They don't want it trivialized. They don't want it turned into a made-for-TV movie. They want the real stuff on the page. So it was a huge responsibility, and I felt better equipped to handle it because I've been through what I've been through. Mm-hmm.
Are there any particular scenes from either of your two books, Seabiscuit or Unbroken, that you play perhaps over in your head when you're facing a significant challenge in your life or facing, you know, particular moments of challenge? Anything that of those two, anything of Louis Zamperini that you go back to?
Probably many different things. Let me think. You know what I actually think of? It's not Louis Zamperini. It's another person in Unbroken. Stanley Pillsbury was the top turret gunner on Louis' B-24 bomber. Mm-hmm. And there is a very harrowing experience that these men went through when fighting off Zeros after bombing Nauru Island. And a Zero was coming at Stanley Pillsbury, and he had been shot in the leg with a cannon, and his leg was horribly mangled. He was terrified. He was a very quiet and recessive kind of man. He did not have a swaggering kind of personality that you think of in a war hero. But he had this moment where he's in agony with his leg dangling down, and the plane has been hit 600 times by cannon fire and bullet fire. It's likely to crash. And somewhere inside himself, Stanley found this wondrous strength, and he pivoted in his motorized chair, and he took aim, and he could see the Japanese pilot flying toward him, and he thought, I have to kill this man. But he had to do it to save all the men aboard his plane. Mm-hmm. And so he fired, and he shot down the Zero, and he saved everybody on the plane. And that is something I go back to a lot, because Stanley had no idea that he had that kind of strength in him, that he could do that. None of us knows what we would really be in these circumstances of extremity. And Stanley found out that day, and he's an ordinary man, but he found out that he had a heroic heart. And I like to remember that when I feel frightened, when I feel too small for my circumstances, I remember Stanley, and I think maybe it's in me too. And that's been tremendously inspiring. That was a wonderful part of the book to write for me, because I smiled at it, because mm-hmm. of the men I interviewed, he was the last man I would think would be the hero, but he was.
Fascinating. I read that you hardly ever listen to music anymore because it arouses all of this yearning in you. Is that still true?
That's a lot less true. I am opening myself up to that. I had to do a lot of shutting down of my senses. To protect myself emotionally, because I was just suffering so acutely. I couldn't stand certain things. And music is tremendously evocative, and it was just too hard for me to listen to it. There would be too many songs on the radio that were resonant of my healthy teenage years and all the hope that lay ahead of me for my future, or songs that were wistful and sad, and I didn't want to be brought to that place because I was always trying to climb out of it myself. And so I avoided that. I avoided books that were sad. I avoided movies that were sad, or in any way would arouse those particular emotions of loss in me. I am much more optimistic now. Life has gone better. I'm in love. I'm hopeful. I have taken this huge leap, and I made it. And so I now do listen to music. I still don't read books that are sad or violent and things like that. I still protect myself a little, but I don't have to do it like I used to. It was absolutely necessary before.
And is that because the emotional energy is too much to read something sad, and that you can't put your emotions into that because you need to conserve your energy?
It wasn't about conserving energy so much as trying to keep my emotional self together.
Mm-hmm.
Because the loss that you experience with this disease is so profound and comprehensive. You lose everything. I lost all my friendships. I didn't just lose my body and my athleticism, my ability to take care of myself. I lost almost everybody I was connected to in the world. I was in a constant fight for respect from people who suddenly had contempt for me. And it was a very, very distressing situation. I didn't know if I was going to die. I didn't know if I would live 60 years in a bedroom and then die. I didn't know if anything was ahead of me. And so you're having to do this moment-to-moment fight to keep it all together, to keep hope in you somewhere, or to just keep breathing when the hope is gone. And the hope did go a lot. But you just go, okay, I'm going to go these next 10 minutes, and I'm going to keep breathing. And I hung up a watch in my window and just looked at that watch and marked out 10-minute increments of time. I will get through these 10 minutes, and then I'll worry about the next 10 minutes. And that was years of my life doing that. So you do have to do a lot of self-protection emotionally to keep yourself together when really all is lost.
How can you incorporate, you know, Kathy Zanana, who is the deputy editor of the magazine, she's listening to this, actually. She is a great fan of yours also, so shout out to Kathy. How does the people who love you and love your writing, like Kathy, like my wife, like me, like people who are just read, you know, my wife is somebody who could care less about a racetrack and a horse, et cetera. And she thought that was one of the most gorgeous books she's ever read in her life. How does that impact you when you know you touch so many people, that your writing is so beautiful, that you know, that you've written two books that are, you know, mega, mega, mega hits? Does that help you with a sense of being and help with all that loss that you've gone through in your life and losing all? How do you incorporate that into your well-being, into your head?
Having been able to write the books was life-saving for me. It gave me an ability to connect with the world. It gave me an escape from my body. It enabled me to create things that had importance. These are not books that the world will turn upon forever. These are stories from history, but they are very inspiring stories, and mm-hmm. they do bring joy and relief and peace to people when they read them. And that means a great deal to me. I had lost the ability to connect with the world in any way at all. I mean, even just talking on the phone, I couldn't do. And I was able, though, to write these books and tell these stories and reach out to people I would never meet all over the world and create something. And so it validated my life. It made, for a long, long time, I struggled to understand what the point was of having lived through so much suffering,
mm-hmm.
because my life had amounted to nothing in that time. And to be able to create something that was meaningful to someone was everything to me. Suddenly, I had a purpose in the world. There was a reason for me to have lived through what I lived through, because I could then go on and write these books. And, you know, maybe they would make someone happy one day. And that meant a lot to me. It meant an enormous amount. It was very freeing to me. It changed the way I thought of myself also, because I think most patients will tell you that it's terribly humiliating to have this particular disease, because it isn't taken seriously, and you are treated with terrible contempt, sometimes by your own family. And you lose that respect that you normally have in conversing with the world, because people are really spilling contempt on you all the time. And it gets to you after a while. You start to feel like nothing, because you're told that all the time, and that you're lazy and that you're useless. I mean, these were words I heard a lot. Well, when I wrote those books, I wasn't lazy.
Yeah, right.
Anymore. I was proving what I was. Mm-hmm. It was really, really hard to write those books with this disease. It was not, it's never easy to write a book, but to do it with vertigo and to do it with exhaustion was, it took every bit of me. And in both cases, the writing the books created a terrible crash in my health. But it was worth it. I would do it again because of the self-respect I got out of it. Because at one point, I made an appearance when Seabiscuit was at number one on the bestseller list. I made an appearance in a Barnes & Noble, and hundreds of people came. And it was an extraordinary experience, because I'd really been alone for a long, long time in a bedroom, really not talking to anybody. And I go there, and there's this mob of people. And I was sitting on the stage talking about the book, and I just paused for a moment to kind of be in the moment and be aware of everything around me. I looked out over all those faces, and every single person there was smiling at me. And that was so beautiful. And then my eyes hit on one person right in the middle, someone I knew, a person who had heaped contempt on me over this disease, who had told me I was lazy, who had told me I was just trying to get attention, that I was manipulating, that it was all fake. And that person was frowning. That person was unhappy. And that person's contempt had been very compelling to me at the time when I was very sick. And I had believed the message I got from that person, that I was worthy of contempt, that I was lazy, that, you know, all these things must have been true. And at that moment, I was free of that person, because that person was surrounded by an ocean of people who liked me for who I was and what I'd done. And I had proven to everyone in there that I was not lazy, that I was not a malingerer, which was a word that was used about me. And it was one of the best moments of my life. I will never forget it. I go back to it a lot. The books have been a great gift for me. Mm-hmm. They really have.
What's the underpinning? What do you think are the underpinnings of the contempt? What's that all about? Why this? I don't know if there's any other disease that has brought about what I hear from people with it, is brought about more contempt from people than CFS. What's that about?
I believe it is about the people who heap the contempt. It's not about the patient. I think people are very afraid of the idea that they could get a disease for which there is no cure, for which there is no real transformative treatment, and there's no explanation. They don't want to believe in that level of chaos in the world. They want to believe they're safe. And we, as people suffering from this, are evidence that this can happen. And so I think that's part of it. They want to deny that. So they need to deposit us in the category of mentally ill or depressed or malingerers or lazy or whatever contemptuous column you want to put us in, instead of accepting that this is a real and not understood disease. And I think in the case of doctors, there's an arrogance there, that they believe that they can run a blood test and understand what's wrong with someone. And when they can't do that, they're frustrated. They feel futile. They feel impotent. And that makes them angry with patients. I encountered that many times where patients, where physicians would be angry with me because I was so sick. And that was when I would start to get the, well, you're an adolescent. You're going through puberty, when I was in my 20s. And puberty doesn't cause these symptoms. And where people would deny symptoms that I had that were undeniable. A blood pressure of 70 over 50 is extremely low. But I had a doctor look straight at that and say, that's fine, that's normal. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm about to faint. And I think that that's, I think it made them angry. I think it made them feel dethroned to have a disease they really couldn't understand. So I think it actually isn't personal. It's about the helplessness of the people around the patient. They just want the person to just get better and stop being a quandary. And, you know, it's also just easy. It's fun to for some people to mock people who look like, well, you know, you hear a name like CFS and you think, well, that's silly. What a silly name. That's obviously made up. This is not a disease. You know, there's a lot of things that contribute to it. But I think mostly it's a sense of futility and helplessness.
Do you feel contempt for the medical community?
I felt very, very angry for a long time about it. Angry with specific doctors who were particularly appalling in their behavior toward me. And the damage that caused within my family and for me personally, the anguish of it. I don't feel contempt for the medical community. You know, different doctors are different people. I got my diagnosis from a wonderful guy, the head of infectious diseases at Johns Hopkins, who was the first person who was willing to say, you have a serious disease, and the other people who have dismissed you are simply wrong. And I don't know what's wrong with you, but I believe that you're very ill. And that took humility for him to say. And I am so grateful for it. I walked out of there happy, even though he said, I can't treat you. I don't know what to do for you. But simply telling me I respect you, and I have a limit to my understanding of disease, was a beautiful thing. And then, you know, I have seen doctors since then. My physician in Washington, D.C. would exhaust himself trying to help me. I mean, he would stay with me for hours. He would make house calls because I couldn't come to him. He was wonderful to me. So I don't blanket the whole medical community for what some people did back then. And I am treated with much more respect now. Mm-hmm.
What are you working on now? Can you give any clues, any hints, any...
I am working on a book. It's a great story. I'm not telling anybody what it is, but I'm excited about it. I think it's going to be a whole lot of fun. I've had to take a lot of time off to change my life as much as I have, you know, to make this move and to do all the new things. Everything is new. Everything I'm doing is new. And so right now I'm kind of favoring my greater freedom that I can ride in a car now. So I do every day. We drive around and we go up on Mount Hood and, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of giving myself the gift of not working much at the moment. But I am starting on this new book and I am excited about it.
Laura, thank you so much. It's really been a delight to talk to you.
Oh, thank you. It's been a delight to talk to you, too. And I appreciate your covering this. It's always good. Every time someone does, it pushes the needle a little more toward people getting research money and patients getting accepted, and that's terribly important.
The preceding program is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of Stanford University. One-to-One is produced by the School of Medicine's Office of Communication and Public Affairs. For more information, please visit us at mednews.stanford.edu.